Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. This is John Titus and Catherine Austin Fitz from Money and Market. We're recording on September 13th for publication on September 14th. And John, a very appropriate theme this week.
Yeah. it's think global, pushback local.
Right. And pushback it is. It's more and more and more. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's actually some stories that you could really slot in any, you know, and sort of the subject matter categories. But, you know, pushback, again, it's the leading category.
Right.
Of stories.
Right.
You know, because there's so many of them and they're all good.
Right. Who was it who said, just throw a wrench in the gears, you know, just, you know, add friction. I think it was C.J. Hopkins, and people are adding friction all around the planet, and it's good.
Yeah.
It's good. I read the G20 report today. We'll talk about it more later, but they said, oh my God, we're only 12% of the SDGs are on track. We're falling further behind. Yay.
Goodness. Okay. The first story is in Crisis Watch, and it's not really a story. It's kind of a reminder that the banking crisis hasn't gone away. And this is from Wall Street on Parade. And what's new here is that the FDIC has released, you know, it puts out quarterly reports, and it's put out a quarterly banking profile. It also put out statistics at a glance. Pam and Russ Martins are talking about the quarterly banking profile. And basically, they're taking an issue with what the FDIC says is this problem banking list. And you can see the problem banking list. I mean, this is sort of a tell. They're telling you in 08, here are the problem banks in 08. Obviously, that's lowballing it, because you can see over here, the horse is already out of the barn. Kind of the same deal here. And they say, look, last Thursday, the FDIC put out the quarterly banking profile for the second quarter, and it includes the problem bank list. And they go on to how ridiculous this list is. They said, look, a problem bank list in the first quarter showed 43 banks with total assets of $58 billion, okay? 43 banks, $58 billion. So basically, a little bit over a billion a bank, but not much. But then they say what happened, unfortunately, on March 10th, Silicon Valley Bank, which is one bank, blew up, and it had assets by itself of $209 billion. And then 2 days later, Signature Bank blows up with $110 billion. So it wasn't 43 banks. It was really two banks with $320 billion, not $58 billion. So they're saying, look, the FDIC is all wet. The top of the FDIC, you can kind of forget what they're saying. The value of the FDIC is in the data that's in the quarterly banking profile. But if you expect the top heads of the FDIC to sort of tell you the truth about what's going on based on that data, you're out of your mind.
Right.
You're on your own.
So I wanted to ask you, who does the FDIC have on the list? Are they all small banks?
They don't. That's one of the points in the article. They just say, hey, there's 46 banks, and they don't name them.
They drop
a foot. No. No, hell no.
Right. Well, they don't want to start a run, too.
They drop a footnote and say, yeah, banks come on the list, and they go off the list. They're not going to tell you who they are.
Right.
That, again, it gets back to the debt-based monetary system. It's like, well, you can't have transparency because the money's all fake and we don't want to run, it would hurt everybody. Yeah.
I don't know. If I was the FDIC and I put somebody on who was working and I thought they would come off within a reasonable period of time, I wouldn't want to disclose either.
Yeah, right.
Right.
But you wouldn't have that problem in an honest monetary system.
Right.
That's not debt-based.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, you'd have the problem a lot less. You still have, you know, you still have dishonest bankers no matter what you do.
For sure. Yep. Okay. So we ended up with... The FDIC, they're not going to tell you what's up with the head of the FDIC. The powers that be in the FDIC aren't going to tell you the score. The data is fine.
Right. But if you go back, and I forget when it was, this was about 6 to 12 months ago, the video of the FDIC meeting where they're talking about, you know, how unstable the system is, and they're not going to tell anybody. And they're not going to raise fees on the banking system to shore up the fund.
Right. And indeed, they're not going to tell anybody. And then in the list of 46 banks, there's not a list. It's just an announcement. There's 46 problem banks and a footnote that says, hey, banks jump on the list and they come off the list. Don't nothing to see here. Move along. But they don't tell you who.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, the crisis isn't going away. You can look at the Fed data. You can look at the deposit data. You can look at the uninsured deposit data. And you can look at individual banks and see crisis is still very much on.
Right.
If
you look at the Fed policies, I just think they're engineering a consolidation of the banking system.
I agree.
They're creating a crisis, and it's being done intentionally.
I agree. We talked about it last week, that Fed paper at Jackson Hole saying, listen, we're going to monetize debt. That's a signal that they're going to continue asset purchases willy-nilly, and that's going to put further strain on the banking system. No question about that.
Right. Yeah. Right. They need the banks to buy treasuries instead of make loans.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The banks have to be used as either the banks are going to be buying treasuries or selling treasuries, okay, or their customers are. Either way, the banks are involved in QE. So that's it. The banking crisis is not going away. It just hasn't gone anywhere. It's just kind of, it's taken a little summer vacation, but it's still around.
Right.
But let's right now turn to FedWatch. And the first story in FedWatch is this, just what we talked about at the top of the show, which is this could just as easily be slotted as a pushback story. And this is Missouri versus Biden. Let me just cut to a local publication. This is the Missouri Independent. Court reduces restrictions on Biden administration with social media platform. And this concerns the Fifth Circuit has now looked at the district court's opinion, and it agreed with the district court that the Biden administration violated the First Amendment. Big time black eye on the Biden administration. But let's look at this article. A federal appeals court in Louisiana, that's the Fifth Circuit, agreed on Friday evening with Missouri's AG that the Biden administration, quote, this is the Fifth Circuit quote, ran afoul of the First Amendment by threatening social media platforms over posts spreading misinformation. The appeals court order vacated much of the lower court's injunction, with the exception of a provision it narrowed concerning alleged coercion. It's not alleged coercion, it's adjudicated coercion. As an initial matter, writes the Fifth Circuit, it is axiomatic that an injunction is overbroad if it stops the defendant from engaging in legal conduct. Nine of the preliminary injunction's 10 prohibitions risk doing just that. Moreover, many of the provisions are duplicative of each other and thus unnecessary. But let's be clear up front. The Fifth Circuit is agreeing with Judge Dowdy at the district court that the Biden administration violated the First Amendment. The question is, what do you do about it? And what they're saying is, well, your solution is a little overbroad, but you're right, they did violate the First Amendment. Okay,
right.
And we'll get into more detail in this in a minute. Let's just finish off this article. Friday's order will not go into effect for 10 days, giving federal officials time to appeal to the Supreme Court, which is probably going to be eager to hear this one. Friday's order pilloried the Biden administration's efforts to combat misinformation by pressuring social media companies to remove posts. So I want to talk about this for a little bit. This case was a preliminary injunction, meaning the Missouri AG went to court and said, you need to stop Biden, and you need to stop him right now. And when you do that, when you go for a preliminary as opposed to a permanent injunction, your burden of persuasion is a lot higher, and you have to muster a much stronger showing. And they did that. So there's really three parts test when a public entity, when a federal government's involved. It's, are you likely to succeed on the merits? Missouri AG wins on that one. Biden loses. Are you causing, is the defendant, the White House, causing irreparable harm? They won on that. And do the equities favor an injunction? And they did. And so this is basically a win for the Missouri AG, and it's a loss for Biden. And the court goes on, and it says, it kind of has a scorecard of who did what. And it says, listen, here are the... Not everybody in the executive branch violated the First Amendment. The wrongdoers are the White House, the Surgeon General, and the FBI. They're big-time wrongdoers because they did, no doubt, coerce the social media platforms. And the CDC also violated the First Amendment. It didn't coerce, but it encouraged certain positions, which is a violation of the First Amendment. And then the appeals court said, not so much, you know, NIAID, the State Department and CISA, CISA did, they didn't violate the First Amendment. But the black eye is for sure on the White House and the FBI. The nation's law enforcer, it's the nation's cop, violated the First Amendment by coercion. This is a tremendous black eye on the Biden administration.
Okay, so the case now goes back to the original judge with more guidelines from the appeals court, and now the original judge has to decide the underlying case. It's not just an injunction. He's got to decide the permanent rules of the game. Am I not correct?
Well, I think that the preliminary injunction is, yes, you are in the long term, but in the short term, he's got to follow their guidelines on what the scope of the preliminary injunction is. In other words, what order is the White House and the executive branch going to have to follow until the permanent case is decided? And they've given him guidelines.
So he's going to use those guidelines and give them instructions on what they can and cannot do until the permanent decision.
Exactly.
Okay.
And they said, you know, those 10 things, and we talked about those on a previous episode, the 10-part injunction, which is, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there. They said, you're going to have to pare that way back, which is true. But there's no doubt that the Biden administration violated the First Amendment. The question is, how do you write the injunction, the preliminary injunction, to stop them from doing certain things? And they gave them guidelines. And you're right. It does go back to the original judge. There's a rule in most every circuit court of appeals I've been involved in, there's a rule that said that you can invoke where when you remand a case, it might go back to a different district judge if you're afraid that the district court judge might be somehow vindictive or too involved in the case. But they didn't invoke that rule. It's going back to Dowdy. It's going back to the same guy who decided the case.
So here's my concern. So I'm just reading this with a layman's point of view. But if I understand the appeals court, the government can spend a fortune in taxpayers' money setting up an infrastructure to communicate its position on many different issues to social media in a way that makes it really easy for social media to understand what the government wants and how. And then as long as it delivers its coercion separately, the system of everything it wants to do to control social media, you know, can work most of the way.
I think that broadly speaking, that's probably correct. In other words, as long as you're not emailing these people on the phone saying, hey, we don't like what you're doing, when are you going to finish, which the kind of things that Dowdy was complaining about, and you just sort of leave it out there like, here's our opinion, take a look at the White House paper. Yeah, I think that's fair game.
Right. So the government can spend a small fortune dictating to social media as long as it doesn't look like it's dictating, and the dictation can be done separately.
Yeah, and I think that's right, and I agree with you that might be a problem, but the court's answer to that would be, the judicial answer to that would be, that's a legislative problem. If Congress thinks that's a problem, they can rein the White House in. That's really beyond the scope of the courts to do that.
Right.
You know, we can only deal with the behavior at issue, and the behavior at issue, this is law of the case now. In other words, this is stare decisis.
All the appropriators have to say is, we're not paying for that.
Right.
You cannot use taxpayers' money, and you cannot use government officials and government resources to do that.
Right. Congress could do that. Another court might come in and say that itself is a violation of separation of powers. But on the issue before the court, Biden lost big time. All the media saying, oh, we cut back these 10 injunctions. Forget that. Biden, who won and who lost? Biden lost and Missouri AG won, period.
Well, but if you've been sitting in the White House and seen an email go out that would say this, I'm sure you would have told him it was illegal.
I'm sure of the same thing. Yeah.
Right.
Totally agree. Yep.
Right.
Anyway, I think that, you know, all of this is going to be kind of moot. Because that 10-day provision, I think this is headed for the Supreme Court. This is the kind of case the Supreme Court's going to take up.
So they'll take the appeals court decision to the Supreme Court right away, you think?
I think so, because it's the executive branch. It's the top of the executive branch. It's a peer institution with the Supreme Court. You've got a ruling now from a Fifth Circuit, which is a lower court of appeal. I mean, it's the second level down that is binding on the top of the executive branch. So I don't see the Supreme Court punting on this.
Based on what we know about the Supreme Court, I can't fathom them overturning the appeals court on this.
I don't think they will. But I think it's, who knows what happens, Catherine.
Right.
But Supreme Court may step in and address some of the concerns that you raise. It may provide some context and some guidance on what the White House can and can't be doing. This is an exceptional case, the coercion that was going on. I mean, the appeals court, a circuit court of appeals has said the White House, calls them out by name, the White House and the FBI and the Surgeon General coerced social media platforms in violation right. of the First Amendment. That's staggering.
Well, you know, it's funny because look, reading the emails, when I was in government, people knew not to be that bold and that blunt.
You knew not
to put that in writing.
Right.
But I hate to say it, when you read it, you have all we used to call them special assistants. They're very young. They come in. They're very eager. They do what you tell them to do something. They'll do whatever you say.
Yeah.
And, you know, they would do things that were frightening and that, you know, it just looks like a bunch of special assistants, you know, in legal free fall.
Yeah. I mean, when I started litigating very, very early in my legal career, partners in this boutique I worked in sat me down and said, listen, you don't write down anything. Everything you write down, you should assume that a court's going to look at.
Exactly.
And they had all these stories, like even private notes in your own copy of a case. You know, they would cite cases where people were, that judge is a real jerk, and somehow that paper gets faxed to the wrong person and ends up in front of the judge who's being called a jerk.
Right.
Don't write it down. These people weren't only writing it down, they were communicating it. This is a junior varsity operation from top to bottom.
I couldn't agree more. I always find it shocking.
It is. It's stunning how dumb these people are. Really,
well,
I mean, to be blunt.
We're back to Bill Moyers. The problem with thinking anything goes is anything can come back to bite you.
Wow. It's just amazing, this case.
But I have to say, kudos to the Missouri AG, who's now a senator, and kudos to the Louisiana AG, who was with him on doing this. So
yeah, this is a once-in-a-generation feather in his cap, for sure.
Yep.
He took on Goliath and won big time.
Yeah.
Okay, let's keep it going in Fat Watch with the story. This is a hilarious story about that electric vehicles. Okay. And what makes it kind of funny is the story comes from NPR. Electric cars have a road trip problem, even for the Secretary of Energy. So NPR wants electric vehicles and went on this trip. Here's the story. When Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm set out for a four-day electric vehicle road trip this summer, she knew charging might be a challenge. But she probably didn't expect anyone to call the cops, which is what happened. Granholm's trip was a publicity tour. It was intended to draw attention, and it certainly did, not for any of the right reasons. What happened here? Well, she had an entourage. So that entourage was a caravan of EVs, including a luxury Cadillac Lyric, a hefty Ford F-150, and an affordable Bolt electric utility vehicle. Okay.
Sounds very energy expensive to me.
So they needed to charge this whole fleet. Her advance team realized there weren't going to be enough plugs to go around. So an energy department staffer tried parking a non-electric vehicle by one of those working chargers to block it off. Okay. So he parks a gas guzzler via a charging station to block the public off. What happens? A family that was blocked up, that was boxed out on a sweltering day with a baby in the vehicle, was so upset they decided to get the authorities involved, and they called the police. And that was that. That blew up in their face. That's just utterly hilarious. That whole thing just blew up in her face. And the end of the story goes on and says, you know, what makes this really bad is that the public is really getting tired of electric vehicles as it is.
Right.
They say here, look, according to the auto data giant J.D. Power, worries about public chargers are the number one reason why would-be EV buyers are reluctant to make the switch, even outranking concerns about high prices. And driver satisfaction with public chargers is getting worse, not better. And that was happening before this PR disaster blew up in Granholm's face. Way to go.
Right.
Yeah.
The electric cars are creating an enormous amount of friction. Now, do you have that graph?
Indeed,
that
I
sent on electric cars.
Let's take a look.
I took a look, and China's in the lead, of course, on electric cars and manufacture of electric cars.
Right.
And we see BYD, the Chinese company, you know, in the lead.
Yeah.
Europe is number two. U.S. is way behind both China, way behind China, way behind Europe.
Wait, you're,
but of course, Tesla is number two in terms of, and you see Teslas everywhere. When I was in Hong Kong in 2019, I was, you know, one of my subscribers chauffeured me around in his brand new Tesla because they were giving big credits to buy electric cars then. So, and then you see, you know, one of the things you see is how the German companies are really being turned upside down, trying to,
Boy, look at that.
You know, it's causing a lot of pain, especially with the higher energy prices here.
They come in at 4, 5, and 6.
Yeah.
I didn't even notice that. That's astonishing.
Yep. So Europe, big push on electric cars. But if you look at what's happening with inflation and interest rates, and the problems with the chargers, I just think there's tremendous friction within the auto industry and within the consumers and in electric cars. And of course, as you know, I think the whole goal of electric cars is control.
Oh, yeah. So I totally agree with that. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. It has nothing to do with the environment. It has nothing to do with energy savings. That doesn't. All the dirt and grime is upstream. It's just hidden from view. It's a complete control system. Absolutely right. Yep.
Right.
Okay, let's keep it going with a story out of good old Austin, Texas, in FedWatch still. New York Post, short-staffed Austin police urge robbery victims not to call 911 as crime ravages the city. Austin police in Texas are asking residents to call 311 if they get robbed near an ATM as the department struggles amid an increase in urban crime and staffing shortages. 311 is a number usually used for non-emergency requests as opposed to 911. Compared to 2020, look at this. This is insane. 3 years ago, Austin has had a 77% increase in auto thefts, an 18% increase in aggravated assaults, and a 30% increase in murders. Wow.
Well, when your borders are wide open and, you know, millions of people are leaving California and coming across, and you have significant inflation hitting households, you know, it's a cocktail that's bound to create something like this. But if you want to know why people in the Heartland are so rabid about the Second Amendment, here it is.
You got it. It's right in your face. Right. Austin is about, it's 200 miles and change from the Mexican border.
Right.
So it's not that far away, but that's a decent buffer. But you see those numbers. I mean, the staffing shortage, because we know from Kennedy and other people who've been right at the border, that it's a lot of criminals flowing across the border.
Right.
You know, you think this is a coincidence that the sluice gate of criminals 200 miles is causes an increase? That's not a coincidence.
So here's the thing to understand, and I'm just talking as somebody who's worked in government and worked as a contractor with government.
Yeah.
The minute the establishment wanted this to all stop, both at the border or the Austin police force, it can be fixed like that. The thing you need to understand about the system, whenever you look at it, it's working perfectly.
Yeah.
It's working perfectly.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And the minute they want it fixed, it can be the speed at which it could be turned on its head and work right, not a problem.
Would amaze you.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's right. Okay, let's turn to this next story. I can't wait to get your take on this. Like, is there something wrong with this story? We'll get into it. It's from SFGate. 45,000 home mega development nears approval in Central California. Okay. A massive development that could include 45,000 new homes and 150,000 residents is nearing approval in Central California. Let me stop right there. 150,000 residents and 45,000 homes, that's over 3 people per home. The U.S. average household is about 2.68. So right away in this story, it's like, well, okay. Why are you higher than average? Is this number real or is this a fudge? Is the real number like higher, maybe 200 or 300? I don't know. I'm going to raise this because
they're planning on a lot of kids. These are going to be young families.
Okay. Well, let's keep it going. Let's just look at another stat in this story. The project, generically called Southeast Development Area, would transform the city of Fresno. The area, which is currently mostly rural, covers 9,000 acres. Okay, so let me get this straight. You got 45,000 homes on 9,000 acres. If my math is correct, and it is, that's 5 homes per acre, mm-hmm. or 0.2 acres per home. But that mm-hmm. assumes there's no roads, no parks, no hospitals, no schools, nothing. There's no public areas. When mm-hmm. you kind of factor that out, it's about 0.1 acres per home. Those are really right. tiny lots for all those right. people. Huh. Right. Interesting that you're planning a lot of kids there in such a small, small, little, tiny area. Okay, right. let's keep it going. The scope of the development has many locals worried. School officials who spoke with Fresno Land estimated an expansion of that size would necessitate 16 new schools to the tune of $1 billion. It's, you know, the money is scarce. And so what's the answer to this? They're like, ah, don't worry about it. The Southeast Development Area, the plan only says the housing, it was going to support all income levels. So there's no, they don't have any answer at all to this. What in the Sam Hill is going on in Fresno?
Okay, so there are a couple possibilities. One is there is a potentially a lot of manufacturing returning to Silicon Valley and to California, and they need to make housing for it, right? So you have a lot of immigration coming in, and Silicon Valley is busting at the seams, and so you're creating a Silicon Valley North, and you're creating housing, you know, Silicon Valley South for, you got a lot of potential remote workers. So that's one possibility. It's going to be much more economic to house them in Fresno than in the San Francisco Bay Area. So that's one possibility.
Yeah.
Another possibility is you're pouring people across the border and you got to build housing for them. So I've sent you a couple videos where they're making these huge mega developments, housing developments. And the question is who are these for? And I think, you know, if you have millions of people coming across the border, you're going to have to build housing. So whether it's Silicon Valley South or it's, you know, people coming across the border, you want housing for them. Now, my big question, and this is a question, is you're building it slightly north of the greatest per capita mortgage fraud area in the country. So. You yeah. know, California used to have, you know, you would have communities where you had as many, if you just counted the numbers, you know, 10 to 100 mortgages on every house. And of course, if you're doing this for immigrants or something else, I mean, let's go back to what we saw at Jackson Hole. They're going to monetize the debt.
Yeah.
Well, if you do it all with treasuries on the balance sheet, it's going to be a little too clear. If you do housing developments like this and put 100 mortgages on every home, you know, that can make a significant contribution to keeping the monetized bubble going. So it would not surprise me if you're looking at a very controlled situation. Now, what's interesting, we know that private investors have bought 55,000 acres not that far away to do another development or more developments like yeah, this.
That's right. But, I forgot about that.
But there is not a word I can find here about who's doing this.
Right. The Southeast Development Area. Yeah. It's like, an article right. never even asked the question.
So this is not going to happen without major institutional capital, you know, deciding that this is going to happen and being prepared yeah. to float the boats. Okay. Yeah. Now, you're probably going to have consortiums of the big home builders coming in and doing this. This isn't going to be one guy. But in terms of investment capital, we know Harvard's been buying up huge tracts of farmland in the area.
Yeah.
So, you know, or in the California Valley. So the question is, you know, Stanford Endowment, Harvard Endowment, the insurance companies, who's the big money who's making right. this go?
And who sold the 45,000 acres in Fresno?
Well, you had the 55,000 that's separate, then this is 9,000, right?
Right.
So oh,
yeah,
totally
sorry, 9,000, yeah. right.
Yeah, so totally you've got, I mean, these are big land moves. Another could be yeah. Buffett. If you look at what Buffett's doing in housing and real estate, you know, he just he's been selling over the last couple of months. So net, his stock portfolio is down, but he's been buying home builders. So you wonder.
Right. You do wonder. Buffett I does. Think your read on that is exactly right. The tell there is a lot size. 9,000 acres, 45,000 homes, you know, back out the public areas. It's 0.1 acre per home. It's tiny.
So what I want, it's going to be like tiny townhouses or row houses. It's almost like a Levittown. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Fresno's Levittown. But
yeah.
what I want to know is who's the big money behind this, number one,
Yeah.
And number two, how many mortgages are there going to be on each home?
Boy, that's a great question.
Right.
Because, like you say, they're going to monetize the debt. I don't know. How many mortgages? If you're right that there's 10 mortgages per home in areas that aren't that far away, say like Riverside, San Bernardino, right?
So I'll never forget. It was 1998 or 99, and I was having lunch at a wonderful, very fashionable Sunday brunch out in the suburbs of Washington. And I was sitting next to someone I had just met who was the chief of staff to the chairman of Freddie Mac. And he looked at me and he said, "You'll never believe where our biggest foreclosure property portfolio and defaulted mortgage portfolio is." I said, "Oh, I know exactly where it is. It's in San Bernardino." And he jumped and he said, "How did you know?"
Wow.
Because if you look at Freddie, Fannie, and FHA, the mortgage, you know, the defaulted mortgage portfolio was just, you know, I don't know if it was bigger than all the homes in that area, but I mean, it was that big.
Yeah.
It was a joke. It was a joke. Right.
Well, obviously 10 mortgages per house, that's a massive amount of fraud and illegality. But that seems to be par for the course, standard operating procedure for this administration, I must say.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And so let's keep it going. Since Biden, you know, he violated the First Amendment, the White House violated the First Amendment, the FBI is out of control, which we're going to see again.
The border's wide open.
It's terrible. Let's look at the head of the executive branch right now, Joe Biden himself, in this clip and see, you know, who's calling the shots here, okay? Let me cut to this clip. This guy is getting worse. I'm telling you, let's just go to this clip. He's at a press conference, and he's going to answer some questions from people in the press. Here he goes.
And let's see. I'm just following my orders here.
Huh.
Staff, if anybody haven't spoken to... No, I ain't calling on you. I'm calling on... I said I had five questions. Anita, from BOA.
Wow. Got to follow my orders here. Just, he's telling you, I'm being controlled.
Right.
Got to follow my orders. They tell me who to call on, and you're not on the list. I'm not calling any. I'm following the orders.
Right.
You like that? No coercion there with the press. No First Amendment problem there. You're not on the list. You can't ask a question.
Right.
Hell with you. That's unbelievable. The next one, next go to another clip. This is the Democratic National Party, the DNC, with Kennedy and all the struggles Kennedy's having to get on, just to get on, basically get a fair election in the primary. So let's just look at this.
RFK Jr. is saying the DNC has just fixed the primary to make it impossible for him to win.
They've made rules that if anybody campaigns in Iowa or sets foot, any candidate sets foot in the state of Iowa or sets foot in the state of New Hampshire, that none of the votes that are cast for that candidate will be tallied. In other words, any delegate that I win in New Hampshire or Iowa would go instead to the president. And now they're trying to change it so that if I campaign in New Hampshire, that none of the votes cast for me in Georgia will count. I would have to win almost 80% of all of the states in order to beat President Biden, even if he only wins 20%.
Democrats love democracy, except you can't vote in Iowa or New Hampshire. RFK Jr. can shake hands, kiss babies, and hold town halls for 6 months and walk away from New Hampshire and Iowa with zilch, not a single delegate. The DNC's giving RFK the Bernie treatment. Remember? Handpicked superdelegates put Bernie in his place the second he became a threat to Hillary. The DNC designed a system to deny insurgents a shot.
Wow, unbelievable.
There's another rule that they are considering where he gets charged a certain amount in very bogus ways. And literally, he would have to, it sounded to me like he would have to raise millions of dollars just to be in a rigged primary.
Yeah, right.
Now, add to that the fact that they refused to give him Secret Service protection, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
To me, the most amazing thing is from his staffers, my understanding, and I believe it, is that their polls show in a head-on match with Trump, they win.
Yep.
And yet, if you go to Real Clear Politics or any of the websites, they never show you, if you look at approval, disapproval, they get Kennedy off the list. And because he has the highest net of approval minus disapproval of any of the candidates, Biden, Trump included.
Yeah.
So he's got a higher net approval than anyone. And sure. On a face-off with Trump, he wins. But they'll never show you that.
Right. They're not going to show you that. Well, that begs the question, what are we staring at here? Are we looking at a replay of 2020? I'm sorry, 2016? Like Jesse Walter just said? Or are we going to get, alternatively, does RFK say, well, the hell with this. This is a ridiculous system. I'm going to run as an independent, which kind of was going
to... I'm trying to think of the historical analogy, but I think you're looking at Venezuela or, you know... I mean, if you look at what the DNC and Biden have done so far, we're really in banana republic space here.
I totally agree with that. The rule of law left the barn a long time ago. The question I got is a little different. Let me put it this way. What do you do if you're RFK Jr.? Do you go through with this charade or do you run as an independent?
So I would keep going in the primary and then I would run as an independent. I would use the primary to build my independent base and then I would run as an independent.
Yeah, this is just that's a sham. This election's just a joke. The U.S. has become just a worldwide joke.
But I would, you know, because Kennedy's very loyal to the Democratic Party and the traditional Democratic ideals.
Sure.
So he's going to keep, you know, he's going to use whatever platform he gets to illuminate what they're doing. So,
yeah.
And if you look at, here's what's happening. He's going to continue to illuminate and Biden is going to continue to get in more and more trouble because of the Hunter Biden allegations and the fact that Biden has been breaking the law for personal benefit. I mean, Biden has been engaging in treason for personal profit.
Yeah, but he's facing a gun charge and that's it. We covered that.
Right. So
more sham.
But I think the president is facing 50% or more of the population believing he engaged in treason for personal profit.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to take a while longer for it to chip through. But McCarthy has announced impeachment hearings. And those impeachment hearings, whatever happens to them, will just bring more attention to the fact that the president broke the law for personal profit. I mean, it's so blatant. You can't. As that comes out, remember, people are struggling with inflation. And that means the whole trade of, I'll pretend the official narrative as long as I get my check. Inflation is eroding the check, and the traditional deal is eroding, which is why they're pushing for so much more control. They can't keep the deal together.
Yeah.
So,
as your lawyer, I advise you not to hold your breath on any impeachment hearings. But in the court of public opinion, the fact that there wouldn't be impeachment hearings. It's just gonna hurt Biden more.
No, I'm just talking about the court of popular opinion.
Yes, exactly.
And what gets attention in the court of popular opinion? I don't expect the House to do anything meaningful.
Neither do I. Right.
Right. I expect inflation. The more you are harmed by inflation, and the more your clock is clocked by the clock eatery, the more angry you're going to get that Biden is making money by selling the country down the river. So.
Yep, I agree. Yep. And that brings up a very big question, which is, who is Biden working for? Administration now under fire for illegal, reckless cancellation of Alaska oil leases. Did someone pay? This is from Zero Hedge. Did someone pay the Bidens to weaken the United States? After canceling the Keystone Pipeline project, draining the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to dangerously low levels, and vowing no more drilling on U.S. soil while America's geopolitical adversaries, two of whom paid his family handsomely, the Biden administration has done it yet again. Last week, the administration confirmed that it will cancel 7 controversial oil and gas leases in an area of Alaska known as Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which were legally awarded from a 2021 sale. Interesting. So sold on Biden's watch. as the climate crisis warms the Arctic, this is Biden responding. Why are you doing this? I'm just going to read the first few words. As the climate crisis warms the Arctic, blah, 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 blah. So it's climate and I have free reign to do whatever I want to line my pocket.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Yep. Climate, 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 climate. You know, it's my answer for everything. This guy is unbelievable. This administration, he's a useful, remember, he's got to take his orders. He said that himself at the press conference. Right. I got to take my orders. Whoever's issuing the orders, they're going to be really happy with this guy. Really happy. Because he'll do anything.
We're not going to cover it, but as you know, Tucker Carlson had an unusual interview with somebody who's been claiming bad behavior by Obama for a long time. And of course, you know, I think Obama's running the Biden White House, but... the shocking thing about the interview, if it's true, is it does give you a good feeling for the personal behavior and conduct of the crew we're looking at.
Yeah. Yes, right. It does. It gives you a view. These stories are just, it's one jaw drop after another reading these stories, just openly lining their pockets. Openly right. Talking about coercion, openly sending emails, coercing people. This administration is just a criminal enterprise. It's astonishing.
Well, I would call it a shakedown. Yeah. These are shakedown artists. But yeah. I would also say, you know, when the central bankers want to get someplace, they put shakedown artists in there.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Again, if they wanted to, you know, just like if they wanted to provide proper staffing and resources to the Austin Police Department, if they wanted competent leadership in the White House, bam, you'd have it like that.
Yeah, you would.
And the speed at which they could engineer it would dazzle you.
I know.
Right.
Like you said, the way to understand the world is it's working exactly as it's intended to work by whoever is issuing orders to Biden.
They want to break up the country, and this is how they do it.
Yeah.
The problem Kennedy has is he's giving a speech saying he wants to unify the country. That's not what they want. They want to tear it apart.
No unity.
Yeah.
No.
That's where Trump comes in. He's going to do a much better job of tearing it apart.
Bad, bad Bobby. Bad. Bad. No unity. Anyway, let's keep it going and change gears to war in Ukraine. This next story, this is the first story. This is the first of two stories from Yahoo, which is, you know, probably one of the leading purveyors of empire conventional wisdom. Get a load of this.
They're fighting for market share. They got to get some market share back.
Unbelievable. Ukraine's counteroffensive is stalling. The West must prepare for humiliation. This is written by Colonel Richard Kemp. Wow. Prepare for humiliation. But Kemp's on drugs. We're going to see that. I'm going to show you that unequivocally. Time is running out for Ukraine. After 18 months of war, it is no longer a question of Western alliance will falter, but when. No, it's no longer a question of if the Western alliance will falter, but when. And then the blame starts, okay? We've got to blame people for our failure. That's imminent. France and Germany, they've been reluctant partners. President Biden, too, he's been dragging his heels, giving just about enough military assistance to keep Ukraine fighting, but intentionally not enough to enable victory. Okay. And the public, the naughty public. Polls in both Europe and the U.S. shows public support for military aid to Kiev dropping away, with one recent survey indicating that less than 50% of Americans are in favor of additional funding. Growing disquiet about Ukrainian corruption. So we can blame Ukrainian officials too. They're causing people sour. Okay. So what do we do about all this? And here's where the drugs come in. Here's what we need to do. Humiliated West will need a robust damage limitation strategy. This would involve building up NATO forces.
Oh, great. More arms sales.
Yeah, Yahoo. More arms sales, yeah. More soldiers. We need more soldiers. Your sons and daughters need to go up there. Here's where the real, this guy's like, are you out of your mind? A second prong would be continued economic warfare against a weakened Russian economy. Okay. What do we do here? Another important track is for Western states to sponsor civil legal action against frozen Russian assets, which currently amount to about £600 billion globally. An example of this is the current effort by the British not-for-profit initiative Payback for Ukraine, which is seeking to seize assets through the courts to fund reparation for victims of Putin's aggression. This form of lawfare, get this, this would be a game changer in clipping Russia's wings. So let me get this straight. You freeze their assets. You steal their money. Your treasury has their money. And you're going to really hurt them. So they don't have access to their own money. And this guy's telling you the way to really clip Russia's wings is to give the stolen money. Don't keep it in your treasury. Give it to the victims. That'll show up.
Yeah, you know where it's going to go?
What an idiot.
You know where that money's going to go? If history, you know, if you just look at what happens in history, you know, we talked about the fact that Americans are now getting more and more control of more and more land in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
Right. It will go to fix up the American-owned land.
No doubt about that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
No question about that. But that guy, so he's acknowledging that you did this is a loss. Russia's won this. Ukraine doesn't have a prayer over there. They're finished. I mean, this is the colonel telling you it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And right. We need to blame some people, and we need to figure out where to get the money to.
Right.
Right.
Meantime, The Economist is rolling out headline after headline about how the offensive is continuing, and it's clearly going to be successful.
Okay. Okay, let's go. Let's move to, I guess you could call this is a hybrid between Ukraine and space military global turf wars. But this is also, this is keep your eye on India. This is an important country. G20 nations soften Russian condemnation to reach Delhi summit compromise draws Ukraine ire. The backdrop to this, by the way, is down
I just
here.
Read this whole declaration. I just read the whole thing, including the backdrop, part in the Ukraine. Yeah.
The backdrop to this story is Russia and China, their heads of state, are conspicuously absent from this year's G20 summit. So what happens? So who steps in? The Delhi leader's declaration omitted words from last year's statement that overtly condemned Russian aggression against Ukraine. Wow. So they're not
even
there.
All countries. If you look at their declaration, it referred to all, they condemn all countries.
Yeah.
And ask all countries to not engage in war.
Right. But they don't call out like Russia bad, right. Russia bad. That's gone.
Right.
Right. So the G20 nations overcame differences in reference to the war in Ukraine, reaching a consensus on a joint declaration that paves the way for frameworks on, here's the key, here's what they're doing, frameworks on debt resolution and country-specific climate financing solutions, among other pledges aimed at enhancing development in the global south.
And they make a very big deal about welcoming the African Union to the G20 group.
Yeah.
And I'm sure part of what they had to do was delete the Russia from and say all countries to get Africa in.
So that headline was a bit of misdirection. It really isn't about Ukraine. It's really about, yeah, you soften the words a little bit and you tossed out Russia because Russia's going to win anyway. But look at what they agreed on. And Modi of India is sort of behind this getting a consensus.
Right. If you read the whole declaration, we'll get to this when we talk about crypto. The whole declaration is completely embracing the control agenda and the control grid.
Yes.
Totally embracing it. Now, what they're saying is war's bad, and they're sort of very anti-war, which goes against the empire. But otherwise, you name it, they're embracing the entire control grid, yeah. in a very aggressive way. And they are absolutely promoting the FSB and the BIS. So basically,
so let's, on that note, let's right. cut to, I'm going to jump out of order and cut to the clip
okay.
from the G20. Okay, let's watch okay. this. This underscores exactly what you just said. You're totally right.
Laying the building blocks for a globally coordinated and comprehensive policy and regulatory framework for crypto assets. The global push for clearer policies on crypto assets has gained momentum under the Indian presidency, and a global consensus is emerging on the same. The presidency will support the IMF and the FSB, and FSB is also setting the contours of the regulatory framework for a globally coordinated approach to crypto assets. So the presidency, with the support of IMF and the FSB, is setting these contours. The IMF and FSB synthesis paper, about which I've spoken to the media earlier, including a roadmap. On that, I just want to give my observation. This synthesis paper delves into how the policy and regulatory frameworks developed by the IMF and the FSB, alongside the other standard-setting bodies, will fit together and interact with each other. This paper is now available in the public domain for all of you all to see.
Okay, that's horrifying.
So I read the whole declaration, all 82 pages and footnotes. Uh-huh. I have to tell you, I've never seen a worse pretzel talk in my life than this. And I've never seen more lies per page than any document. This document is so over the top, selling the control grid as sort of helpful, you know, and saving the planet and inclusive. You know, it's the lies are beyond belief. It's phenomenal. But it's most supportive of the BIS and the UN. So it's UN One Health for health, and then it's the BIS for money, and complete support for the control grid, and including with climate change and the Paris Agreement. So this is super ugly, but it does list out all the different documents that show you how they're engineering the global train tracks.
Yeah, which is okay because they're available for your perusal.
Exactly.
But let me just talk about what she just said.
Okay.
This is representative really for the G20, the Indian finance minister, whoever, saying, here's the position, here's what we agreed on. We've got consensus now on crypto assets. And our guidance from
what
this
she means is CBDC.
Right. Yeah, well, it could be quite a bit broader than just CBDC.
Oh, yeah. No, it is broader. But
crypto assets, it's right. Way broader. Okay,
yes.
So it's like smart contracts and stuff. G20 is agreeing on this, and we're getting our guidance from two criminal organizations, the IMF and the FSB. Not the Secret Service in Russia, the FSB meaning the Financial Stability Board, which I talk about in my documentary, All the Plenary's Men, which is housed in the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, and which is a public-private partnership between basically state bankers and state finance people, and private entities come in and they decide policy. They're the ones who came up with a list of the globally systemically important banks that are above the law. That's right. From the FSB. The G20 created the FSB in 2009, and now they're taking direction from the FSB and the shakedown organization, IMF, on crypto right. assets. Oh, joy.
If you look at the details, they're taking it from the FSB and the BIS. They don't mention the BIS here.
No, they don't mention the BIS.
BIS is a hot potato, so FSB right. is a safe way to say it all. But if you look at the list and the framework and who's dictating and writing what and publishing what, it's FSB and the BIS.
Yeah.
And I'll just say it very bluntly. I think, so the FSB has a list of systemically important banks, systemically important insurance companies, and then systemically important payment systems, which are not public. The payment systems are not disclosed. The insurance companies, the banks are disclosed. But as you know, I think the FSB is how the BIS essentially extends its sovereign immunity to a group of banks, insurance companies, and payment systems, which are then free to operate outside the law.
Yeah.
So,
right.
So this is very ugly. Now, one point that they did make in the declaration, you ready for this? You're going to love this. It is essential for integrity of the system that the central banks remain independent.
God.
What that means is privately owned.
Yeah, that's exactly what that means.
So the power that's driving this entire framework are private central banks, and it is imperative that they remain private, therefore secret and above the law.
Yes.
That's what it's, you that's know, that's what the press.
The way they pitch independence in the U.S. is it's like, well, we're an independent agency. And it's like, no, that's what independent agency means in the U.S. legally is you're independent of the executive branch. It doesn't mean you're independent of we the people and our government. But that's right. how that's what they're trying to sell it as. They're like, "Oh, we're an independent agency." It's like, "Yeah, but your version of independence is legally completely bogus."
Right. So if you understand what's really going on in terms of who's who and what the laws are currently, what they're saying is this entire system, which is a harvesting system, is to be governed by a secret governance system which is above the law and private.
Yeah. That's what they're telling you.
And you need to support this because it's inclusive.
And you can everybody can read our we're very transparent about this. We make these decisions, and you can read them. The decision is publicly available.
Right. Just goes to show that with a lot of money, you can get a lot of talented, well-educated people to sling pretzel talk.
Boy, you can. Yeah.
Yeah.
We just saw it. And you can do it in a variety of accents, too.
Right.
Including a
Absolutely.
Nice Indian act. We're a very, very diverse group of people here. Right. But let's keep it going as space military global turf wars. And this really concerns, the U.S. vis-a-vis Europe. This is a good example of what's going on in terms of, what happens when Ukraine loses this war? Where are the chips going to fall? This is from Moon of Alabama. And it talks about what's going on in Africa. The U.S. used its training of African officers to subtly find and train people it could work with. Then an astonishing number of these officers were later involved in coups, which often turned out to be anti-French and pro-American. How about that? After the coup, the French military contingent in Niger and its ambassador were told to leave, while the big U.S. drone base is likely to stay. So France out, U.S. stays. The U.S. has strategic interests in Africa, as the former RAND and CIA analyst and senior fellow of the Atlantic Council, Michael Shurkin, writes. It wants France out. It wants to get out. And this is Shurkin. This is the Atlantic Council writing. France should close its bases and go in Niger. Just get out. What the backdrop to this is, since France rejected the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the U.S. has done its best to deny France any independent international role. The U.S. is just eating France and eating Europe alive.
Right. What's interesting is I would love to see the numbers on the dollar float in those countries. So the dollar is taking market share away.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Yeah. We should find charts on that some week. We don't have them this week, but that's a great question.
Yeah, I'll take a look.
What's going on there? Yeah, that'd be a good thing to know. But let's cut back to another development in sort of the crypto space. And again, this is the BIS directly. So let me cut over to this. Here we go. BIS, Israel, and Hong Kong. This is CBDC. This is all about CBDC. BIS, Israel, and Hong Kong central banks have launched Sella project today, a technological proof of concept of retail CBDC, making payments immediate, cheaper, and more secure, says Daniel Iden, BIS Innovation Hub. So they're just continuing to plug away on CBDC.
So Israel keeps the Israel cyber and crypto companies continue to try and be a lead on the whole CBDC front. And one of the reasons I picked up on this is because we just saw X, Elon Musk, his new term and condition, according to PC Magazine, is you have to agree for all your content to be held for 30 days by a company in Israel.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wonder how that relates to this project.
It's a good question. Anyway, so, but they're the powers that be are plugging ahead on these systems. And keep in mind that these are being spearheaded by the U.S., which we've seen again and again and again just in this episode, being caught red-handed in illegalities, violating the First Amendment.
I can't tell you how many operations, whether they're cyber operations or physical operations, where again and again and again you see it's the U.S., the Brits, and Israel.
Yeah, boy.
Right. If there's trouble, the U.S., the Brits, and Israel.
You'll find them.
We ought to come up with a flag that's a synthesis of the three.
Right. I would propose a van in New York leaving the scene of the 9/11 full of Mossad agents getting arrested and then let off. Yeah.
Right.
Don't want to talk about that.
Nope.
Okay, let's turn to Farmageddon with some good news. Djokovic. This again from Yahoo. This is Yahoo Sports. He won the 2023 Open. Djokovic defeats Medvedev to tie Margaret Court's record of 24 Grand Slam wins. Djokovic has tied what has been considered one of the most unreachable records in tennis, Margaret Court's 24 Grand Slam wins. His win, the U.S. Open, he won his fourth U.S. Open trophy and his 24th Grand Slam title. So he is tied. But then go on, this is an Empire publication. Check out the language on Djokovic, though. He dominated his opponents at the 2023 Open. With the exception of one match, he beat all of his competitors in three sets, going to a tiebreak in just one of them. What makes Djokovic so terrifying as an opponent, even at 36 years old, is that he can handle anything that's thrown at him on the tennis court. He has near infinite comeback powers, and he doesn't look like he'll be slowing down anytime soon. There's no reason to think he won't be in fine shape in four months to compete for his record-setting 25th Grand Slam title. Wow. That's amazing. And this guy
said, it's an amazing athletic competition. Record. It's just an amazing accomplishment.
And just to remind your subscribers, Djokovic is the guy in the sports world who said, absolutely not, you're going to jab me. No thanks.
Right. So it's remarkable how well you can do if you're not poisoned.
Astonishing.
Were you going to show the chart of his wins?
Yeah, let's go to that. Yeah. Here you go. Take a look at that. 24 and counting, plays for the record books. Number of Grand Slam single titles won by pros. There he is.
Yeah, just so past it's only Serena the Williams. Open era after 68. So right. Margaret Court has 24.
Right. He's going to break the modern record and the old record. He's on his way.
Yep.
But this is the modern, what they're showing here. You're exactly right. But look at the names he's passed. These are huge names. All of them are just, these are.
It's an astonishing accomplishment.
He's at the top of a group of bona fide champions. I mean, look at that list.
Right. So
Pete Sampras is at the bottom.
Right. So if he's going strong, God knows where he ends up.
Yeah. 36 years old. And like they said, he's showing no signs of slowing down.
Slowing down. Yeah.
Man. And you got to wonder, you know, how many of his opponents did poison themselves?
I think that's a good question.
You know, I'd like to know. But anyway, he's sitting pretty right now. That graphic is astonishing, him being on top of that. That's amazing. Anyway, let's turn to pushback, because there's a lot of stories.
A lot of stories.
Let's start with, though, the story. I was going to lead off with Tennessee. Uh-huh. But I'm sorry, the winner this week is New Mexico.
Yeah,
this is a sheriff. Remember, New Mexico, everybody know, well, is a backdrop. The governor has said, basically, I'm just going to throw out the Second Amendment. You know, I'm going to do whatever I want, and issued an executive order basically bouncing the Second Amendment open carry laws passed over there. And now here's
right. She said she could declare an emergency. In an emergency, there's no constitution. So
exactly.
Right.
There's no constitution. There's an emergency. That's a decree. Here's a sheriff in Bernalillo County.
Yeah, it's the largest county.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a look at the sheriff and hear what he has to say about her order.
As we all know, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham issued an emergency temporarily suspending open and concealed carry laws for the next 30 days in Bernalillo County. Let me start by saying I'm holding this press conference and to answer many other people's questions, not only on social media, but directly to my phone. One, this is not grandstanding, nor is this to bring attention to myself. We must always remember, not only are we protecting the Second Amendment, but at the same time, we have a lot of violence within our community. Let me be clear. I hold my standards high, and I do not, or never will, hedge on what is right. And I take my oath seriously. In reference to concealed carry and open carry, the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Office will not enforce this segment of the order. While I understand the urgency, the temporary ban challenges the foundations of our Constitution, but most importantly, it is unconstitutional. My oath was to protect the Constitution, and that is what I will do.
Bam.
Well, here's what he's saying. You know, we have real criminals here. The sheriff's office has to stop the criminals. We don't have time to go bust honest citizens.
Yeah. In other words, even if you're right about an emergency, you're coming out the wrong way.
Right.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact there really is an emergency and it's unconstitutional.
Well, the other thing, it's Senator Nicely, who's the hero again this week, said, you know, the thugs, you know, the criminals don't respect these laws. All you're doing is, you know, the criminals are going to keep carrying. Now the honest citizens can't carry. How's that going to help?
Right. That's not, you're not helping. You're not helping. So that's pushback at the county level from a sheriff. You know, he's one of 3,100 sheriffs in the U.S. Let's go now to pushback at a state level, which happens to be in your state, Tennessee. From the Tennessee Star, State Representative Jason Zachary says Tennessee will not comply with new mask mandates if implemented. Zachary said that Tennessee will not comply with any effort by the federal government to reinstate COVID mask mandates. This is Zachary, quote, Tennesseans, reminder. In October of 2021, we were the second state in the nation to pass a comprehensive COVID protection bill. We banned government mask mandates, masks in schools, banned COVID vaccine mandates, banned businesses and schools from requiring vaccine passports, and prohibited the feds from commandeering any state resources to implement COVID measures. Not happening in Tennessee, Zachary said. Wow, not going to work a second time.
Right.
It's awesome.
Love Tennessee.
You got to love it. Okay. Yep. But not to be outdone, now there's also Arkansas pushing back. Let's cut over to Sarah Huckabee in Arkansas and see what she has to say about matters over there.
We also have to be sure that government never again tramples on our liberty like it did during the COVID-19 pandemic. Back then, a handful of bureaucrats shut down our schools, our churches, our businesses, and forced masks on our kids and tried to implement vaccine passports. That will not happen again here in the state of Arkansas. When I took office, I repealed a long list of executive orders related to the pandemic. Now we're going further and banning COVID-19 vaccine mandates for all Arkansas state employees. And our State Department of Health will publicize the potential risks related to the COVID-19 vaccine so that all Arkansans can make informed decisions about their health.
Wow. So we're not only going to ban the mandates and the vaccine requirements, we're going to publish the data.
Right.
Not a good day for Big Pharma in these two states. All bad for them.
Right. You've got a very serious consensus building up in the heartland that they're not putting up with this anymore.
No, the heartland is not putting up with it anymore. Okay. And speaking of which, let's cut over to another story involving pushback. This from Washington Examiner, 60% of active shooters stopped by a good guy with a gun. A large percentage of active shooter incidents are thwarted by armed citizens who sometimes don't even fire their weapons. But those cases are no longer counted under, surprise, surprise, Joe Biden's pro-gun control policies. According to just-released data from the Crime Prevention Research Center, 41% of active shooting incidents were stopped by armed civilians. That number is actually a little low, though, because outside, if that includes gun, this 41% includes gun-free zones, okay? When you get those out of the equation, outside of gun, so-called gun-free zones, which bar the legal carrying of firearms, over 63% of active shooting cases were ended by an armed civilian, according to the center. But wait, if you look at how they're counting the cases, of 440 cases that the reporter cited from 2014 to 2022, 157 active shootings were stopped by armed civilians. However, by comparison, the FBI cited fewer cases, 302, and even fewer cited by armed civilians, 14. However, I would point out that the FBI has just been caught red-handed and condemned for violating the First Amendment. I would now take any statistic from the FDIC with 2 tons of salt and just throw it out. You can safely ignore it because they're a lawbreaker. It's a lawbreaking organization. Just forget what they say.
Right. I couldn't agree more. Although I do have to say on our litigation, the FBI was our friend. They were very good to us.
Times have changed.
Yeah.
They've changed big time. Your litigation was before the bailout. I'm telling you, that was a sea change.
Right.
One of these days I'll write a book on that being the real coup. The legal, it meets the legal definition of a coup, that 2008. There might have been de facto coup beforehand, but that's when they perfected it.
Well, but when they did the bailouts in 89, that was when they started, that I saw, they started pushing out all the quality people.
89 or 98? Long-term
capital management. It was 88, 99. They passed the FIREA in 89. So, and then they started the RTC, and that was 89,
yeah.
90, 91,
yeah, that 92. Was the SNL crisis, right.
Right, so right. So that was the SNL crisis. And from then on, they were just pushing out the quality people everywhere you looked.
Yeah, there's a lot of groundwork being laid, but I'm telling you, the legal perfection was that 2008, the bailout, in my opinion, anyway. Doesn't really matter. There's been a coup. I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah, no, there's been a coup. But but I will say this. After the bailouts, the coup went completely out of control. Yeah. At that point, you completely corrupted and busted the civil service, and there was almost no protection.
The coup was officially green-lighted that year. Yeah, yeah.
Well, the coup had been going on, but it was covert, and they got control
it was de facto.
Right, but when the financial crisis happened, they got complete control of the bureaucracy and the infrastructure, hands down. And then you're talking about, it's like a runaway, you know, a stagecoach that just is a runaway. The horses are a runaway.
Yeah, they went runaway big time because it became official policy that banks are above the law and that lawbreakers are above the law. And that is so extremely dangerous.
Right.
Anyway, a topic for another day. Let's keep it going with pushback out of Israel. Okay? That's just on pharma stuff. Wow, unexpected pushback from Israeli hospitals. When the Israel Minister of Health told them to start PCR testing all inpatients for COVID again, the hospital told them, no, bad idea. Let's see if they continue to hold the line. Here's a letter. It's translated. But basically, the letter, if you zoom down into, here we go. I like how they put this. Here's the hospital writing to the order to start testing. With great respect, the amount of patients arriving for hospitalization due to COVID is low. Therefore, it may be preferable, nice diplomatic language, it may be preferable to conduct this testing survey in the community where most of the patients with respiratory symptoms are located, and there will be a more significant effect to the survey there. The public hospitals will continue to perform PCR tests according to clinical judgment, not willy-nilly. So no thanks.
Right. Well, it's like the case I just sent to you of the decision saying the CDC cannot overrule a doctor. They're not. CDC is not doctors.
Yeah.
So a doctor's medical judgment is superior to the CDC. You know, so they can, using ivermectin off-label. Right.
Yeah.
So if you look at how hideous Netanyahu and his crew have been to Israel, it doesn't surprise me to see pushback in Israel. So I'm regularly communicating with people in Israel, and it's if you look at the death and the disability and the destruction that came out of COVID of that population, it's one of the populations that took it on the chin the worst.
Really?
So it doesn't... The pushback. I know you remember the interview with Zelenko.
Yeah, Zelenko.
And the public health, the rabbis who were running the public health board. And they finally confess and admit, one of the rabbis admits, you know, that he had helped his family by taking hydroxychloroquine, and he thanks him. And Zelenko goes ballistic and says, how dare you use that for you and your family when you were denying it to the people? He just, it's one of the most beautiful.
I forgot about that.
You know, I love that man. Yeah. It's one of the most beautiful scenes we've ever showed on Money and Markets. I think we showed it on Money and Markets.
We did. Absolutely, we did.
It's extraordinary. And he just, but you can't imagine what's been done to the Israeli people. It's heartbreaking. It's just heartbreaking. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Anyway.
Okay, let's wrap it up with pushback. This last example of pushback is a lawsuit, but it also underscores, just again, the rampant illegality going on all corners of the Biden administration. It's unbelievable. I'm just going to cut over to this complaint. This complaint involves what's called Berkey water filters.
Unbelievable.
It's not apparent from the face of this complaint. But this is a lawsuit. It's filed in federal court in Northern District of Texas, Fort Worth. Okay, and the title, you look at the caption here. So let's start with the defendant. The defendant is the EPA and the people in the EPA, okay? The plaintiff is, you'd think it'd be Berkey Filters, but it's not. It's James Shepard. He's trustee for the Shepard Trust and New Millennial Concepts. So it's like, well, who are these plaintiffs? Plaintiff James Shepard and New Millennial Concepts now come, they file suit against the EPA for its violation of the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act, and due process involving Berkey water filters. The plaintiffs here, he's a trustee of the JBS Trust. They're beneficiaries which own equitable title to the majority partnership interest. So it's a partnership that really has Berkey filters' interest in new millennial concepts. And they hold legal title to an intellectual property. So these are the people who own the intellectual property that gets licensed to other entities to manufacture and sell Berkey water filtration products. So what this means
which
is—
Which I have to say are wonderful. They're wonderful.
They?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're wonderful.
The point of this is this company has done well. It's protected itself by not being publicly traded. It's a partnership and they kept things. And the way they do things is they license people to make their filters. But let's cut to the complaint and see the nub of this complaint. They kind of bury it a little bit. I wouldn't have done it this way, but you know what? I'm not litigating this case. But let's just go to the money shot here down in about, it's paragraph 33. What's going on here? Here's the landscape, the competitive landscape for this company. Numerous unauthorized retailers and knockoffs of Berkey products abound. They're all attempting to benefit from Berkey's reputation for excellent products. Berkey struggles with knockoff filters because a knockoff competitor can build filter systems using mundane carbon filters constructed to fit the Berkey filter system as a form and fit replacement, but not a function replacement being made from inferior materials. The knockoff filters are designed to imitate the appearance of Berkey filters, okay? So why, EPA, are you coming after Berkey? Are you also going against the knockoff companies? Nope. Paragraph 34, to plaintiff's knowledge, the EPA is not engaged in enforcement actions against any unauthorized sellers of Berkey knockoffs, making or implying false function claims, but is singling out genuine products, okay? The EPA doesn't like genuine products offered by Berkey, a longstanding American brand known for its quality and performance. That, in a nutshell, is the EPA. The EPA ought to be wiped off the face of the map for behavior.
Well, if you go to Berkey's website, they can't sell. It's not available. You can't shop. Now, you can buy them at Amazon. You can't buy them from Berkey.
Yeah. That's more criminality from the federal government.
Right.
Just in your face. We like criminals. We want them to flourish. And you, people who are working hard and you patented
your stuff. They are intentionally. I mean, this is RICO.
That's infuriating. It so offends me as someone who represented plaintiffs in intellectual property cases.
Right.
That's ridiculous.
They're trying to destroy a good product and a good company.
Intentionally. They're intentionally destroying a product, a genuine product, an American-made product from a company that doesn't play ball necessarily because it's not publicly traded.
While the Chinese knockoffs are going to flourish.
Yeah. The standard, by the way, is for whether somebody violates the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act, is the action by the agency, the EPA in this case, is it arbitrary and capricious? This is completely arbitrary and capricious because it's really not. It's actually malicious. It's beyond arbitrary.
This is malicious.
It's totally malicious.
It's malicious. They're trying to destroy a good product and a good company.
It's disgusting. It's so nauseating.
Right.
Anyway. Okay.
Right.
With that, but that's some good pushback. Good for them taking them to court.
Would the Department of Justice destroy an honest, hardworking, productive company? My experience is yes. They would.
So that's a personally offensive story to you, too. That really bothers me.
So, you know, I told you I litigated. The whole process took 15 years, but I litigated for, you know, up to 11 of those years. It depends on how you count it. And one of the reasons I refused to settle, and it drove my attorneys crazy because they kept canceling the trial. They'd schedule the trial and then they'd cancel it. I mean, games went on and on. And I had to refuse to settle and get to litigate because I had to prove they never had any evidence of any wrongdoing ever. And in fact, I told you the FBI gave us a report saying, you know, we've investigated and there's nothing wrong. And we presented it in court and the judge, who was the former CIA general counsel, who was up to his, you know, he was up to his eyeballs in corruption on the thing. When we gave it to him, he got really angry and he said, "The FBI gave you this?" He was they were going to get the call. They were going to get the call. You know, how's he going to rig a case against us if the FBI is, you know, saying there's nothing there? But of course, the case just droned on. It didn't matter if the FBI said we were clean. But that's why I had to. That's why I had to take it all the way down. And I told you it was amazing because my attorney just turned to me in a state of shock. And he says, "Oh my God, they have nothing." I said, "I've been telling you that for 7 years." He said, "I just couldn't believe there was nothing. It was a bluff." And then literally the week after, I had people circulating rumors. I told you she's really guilty. We just couldn't bring the evidence forward in court.
Yeah, right.
And that's when I realized, you know, if the central banks need the sky to be green, they will never give up doubling down on saying the sky is green.
Right, exactly. I mean, I can't tell you.
Because they can print all the money they want.
How many times I saw reputable firm, name law firms, leading law firms in the U.S., partners in those firms, get up and lie, just tell bold-faced lies again. And even after this, the lie gets called out and busted, they can't deviate from it. And they get up and they tell the same lie again. It's breathtaking.
It is breathtaking.
And it's those people, these criminals that I litigated against, they're rampant throughout the government. It's like, it is the government now. These liars.
Well, you now have people who've been trained in a world where that's just the way things are. There's nothing wrong with doing that.
Right. That's you win. You lie to win.
That's how they've been trained.
Yeah. Right. And they work for, and one of the leading liars was a clerk for a district court judge in the Northern District of Illinois. Just unbelievable, out of control people. Oh, bad news. Anyway, let's turn to charts. You ready?
Okay. I'm ready.
All right. Let's start with the dollar index. I'm curious as to why are we going back to 1966?
I'll tell you why, because I was talking with somebody whose opinion on the markets I really value. And if you look at the spike that happened, you know, a year to two ago,
the dollar went up
to 114. It's now at 104. Now, I wanted to look at the dollar chart because, you know, coming into the BRICS summit, we kept hearing, oh, the dollar's going to collapse, the dollar's going to collapse.
Yeah.
And I was forced into a corner where I said, I have to agree with Janet Yellen. I think it's the first time I've publicly stated that I agree with Janet Yellen because she said, you know, basically all this stuff about the dollar collapsing in a gold-based currency was a nothing burger. And so I agreed with Janet. And sure enough, all throughout the summit and continuing, the dollar has been marching back up. And so I was talking with a friend of mine about where it's going to go. And the question was, would it make it back to 114? He thinks it's going to go back to 120, which if you look, you know, back after 9/11, that's in fact what we hit.
Yep.
So we are in an upward trend. We've been in an upward trend since the financial crisis. And, you know,
That's not much of a collapse for my money.
Yeah, that's not a collapse. We're in a march back up.
Right.
And I think it's important to understand that this is all part of looking at how the going direct reset is doing. And right now what the charts say to me is that the going direct reset is working. And it's one of the reasons I think that Powell is going to keep playing hardball. My read is, my question was, could it get back to 114? He was debating 120. So I wanted to show you where the dollar has been, you know, at coming out of the financial crisis. And then we go back to, you know, all the way back to 85 when we hit that huge high.
On this chart, the first time I went to London, 1985 in the summer.
Oh, you had a good time.
Oh, man. the pounds were free flowing that summer.
Yeah, I remember. So I was in Hong Kong in 1970, and the dollar was, you know, the dollar against the Hong Kong dollar was very attractive. So, you know, I had two motorcycles and lived a nice life. I had a job too. So,
yeah.
Anyway, but the dollar is strong and will probably be headed higher. Here's what you need to know. The big question before us is, if we're moving off the petro standard, we now have everybody in a dollar debt trap. Will a dollar debt trap replace the power of the petro? We don't know. Big question mark. But if the dollar keeps heading up and we get back to 114, you're going to see a world of hurt globally.
And, boy, aren't you ever. Yeah.
Right. And so I think Powell's going to play hardball. And the question is, you know, how much does hardball include a bear dollar trap around the world through the indebtedness? We'll see.
I don't know. But don't feel bad about agreeing with Janet Yellen. Last week, I had to agree with Larry Summers.
What's happening?
What did he say? That he said
I'll bet you Janet and Larry both have a Berkey water filter.
I bet you.
They know not to drink the water.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Okay, right. Let's turn to FinViz. Look at this.
Okay, that's year to date, and you know, inflation is still with us. The VIX is way down, but inflation is still with us. And so the question is Powell? We just saw an announcement from the Wall Street Journal that gas prices are definitely showing inflation. So the question is, will Powell pause or will he bump? I don't know. You know, I think it depends on what data he sees coming into the meeting, but that's the big question. Will he pause or dump?
Yeah, that is the question. I think he's going to keep going, but we'll see. Okay. 10-year Treasury yield.
Yeah, 10-year Treasury yield. We just keep marching higher.
And this is from, why are we looking at back to?
We're looking at the going direct reset.
Yeah.
Higher interest rates, the rise in interest rates is very much part of the reset.
Yeah, look at that. Boy, isn't it ever.
Control, 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 central control. We are engineering central control.
Yep. That is,
and the squeeze is on. If you look at all the things that are going to come to the fore that squeeze a middle-class family next year, it is unbelievable what is rolling down in terms of central control and financial squeeze. So we all have to do everything we can to, you know, sort of batten down the hatches, whether it's our time and money, and make sure we're as little exposed as to what's going to be rolling at us.
Yeah. Okay. I think we have one more. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So again, from the reset on, I just wanted to look, and I have to say the reset's working. S&P up 50%, Europe up 12%, the emerging markets down it's really 4.25%.
Look at this.
And then China large cap. Now, EEM, China's about half of EEM. The thing to understand about when you look at this chart, John, what's so interesting is the growth rates and productivity in Asia are really growing much faster than the West, and certainly faster than the United States. But the United States keeps being able to pull things out of its hat. Right now, the latest announcement from Wall Street Journal is investment managers moving into U.S. equities, and they're saying the property crisis in China is, you know, one of the greatest risks in the sort of impacting the systemic global financial markets. So, you know, no matter how strong Asian growth, the U.S. keeps being able to pull the rabbit out of the hat. And so the empire, whether you look at interest rates or dollar or stock market, the empire is, you know, turtling forward. And it's important to remember that the incompetency and idiocy of the Biden administration does not reflect the people who really run either the U.S. dollar or the euro dollar markets.
Yeah,
you know, and the charts reflect where they're sitting. And right now, they're still sitting pretty. But if you look at the ugliness of what they're doing,
this is just amazing.
Yeah, if you look at the ugliness of what they're doing, yeah, they're playing hardball. And
81%.
Coming out of the Grove, I think the message. Yeah, I think the message coming out of the Grove is, you know, hardball all the way.
Yeah. Anyway, that's an amazing chart.
Yep.
Yeah. The empire, you know, the central bank, the Fed, has got to feel pretty good looking at a chart like that.
Well, think about it. You just had the whole Indian continent lining up and cheering the BIS and the fact that the central banks need to remain independent.
Yep. Yep.
So much for the multipolar world.
I'll probably do a video. I'll do a short video someday on independent central banks. I'm kind of getting some systems in place and I'll reel off a series. Anyway, let's turn to Solarian House and see what is going on this week, starting with Tuesday.
We have a great interview. Toby Rogers is the political scientist who did his doctoral thesis at University of Sydney on what will autism cause society. I call it pricing the great poisoning. He's a very intelligent, very charming, you know, brilliant, kind of very serious scholar. And he rocked the world with his thesis and has been rocking it ever since. So we had a great conversation about, I called it pricing the great poisoning. And, you know, he's looked seriously at what autism is going to cause society. And I'm a great believer, if you look at the number one cause of what's destroying productivity in America, I think it's poisoning. And and so we have a great conversation. I love this guy. I've always loved this guy. And so I've wanted to get him on the Solaria Report for a long time. But it's a really like the Charlie Stevens interview. It's a breakthrough interview in helping you see clearly and simply what's really going on.
Very interesting. Toby Rogers.
And someone to know. I think is really a scholar who has rocked our world and is just doing great work.
How old is he?
How old is Toby? I would say he's late 30s, early 40s.
Wow, so he's young. Yeah.
He's young.
Looks young.
This is a young guy and very, very coherent, very clear, and extremely intelligent.
Yeah, good. So his career's got legs. That's good.
Yeah.
Okay, you mentioned him before. Hero of the week.
Gotta love him. Frank nicely got up on the floor. You know, they were trying to pass red flag laws in Tennessee, and the Republican legislator stopped it. And it was a Republican governor, shame on Bill Leake, who has been hero before, but shame on him. And Senator nicely got up and explained that thugs don't believe in gun-free zones. it was a short speech, but it was a great speech. And he brought us home. Nicely just keeps doing amazing and great things and working hard to protect financial transaction freedom in Tennessee. He's the reason that he and one other legislator made sure that in Tennessee, if you want ivermectin, you can buy it over the counter. You do not need a prescription.
Yeah, that's good. Good for him.
Yeah.
That point can't be hammered enough. Gun-free zones don't matter to criminals.
Right.
Duh. Okay.
Right.
Next up, we have movie. Let's go to the movies. Aloha, a movie I haven't seen. Do tell.
So one of my contacts called me about 6 months ago. He says, you have to have this movie Aloha on the Solari Report. I said, why do I have to have it? And he said, you got to watch it and see it. Well, you know, I was busy. Anyway, a couple months later, he calls me back. He said, you haven't done Aloha yet. You got to get Aloha. I said, what's the story? Well, Bradley Cooper is a defense contractor. He is hired to a former military hero. He's hired by a satellite billionaire who is very Elon Musk-like, played by Bill Murray. And he ends up sabotaging the satellite, which turns out to be a good thing. He gets in big trouble with everybody, but it turns out the satellite was really to deliver weaponry that the military didn't know about. The billionaire was up to no good. And so now he's a hero because he sabotaged it. It's all set within a romantic comedy, but guess where the billionaire and the launch and everything else is?
I don't know.
Maui.
Wow.
Now, Maui has an observatory on the top of Maui that's under the command of Space Force.
Huh.
And you keep getting scenes where the general's explaining it's a new millionaire. It's a new military. Now the billionaires are in control.
Interesting. It's a 2015 movie.
Yeah, it's a bit of a slapstick. But when you look at the movie and then look at what's been going on, you know, in the last month and a half in Maui, you kind of shake your head.
Yeah, you do. The predictive programming.
Right.
Always makes you shake your head.
Right. This one is very, I would not say it's a great movie, but I would say it's predictive programming and it's a bit spooky.
Huh. Let's turn to programming of a different sort, and that is upcoming programming. Here we go.
Yeah, so we're headed, Carolyn Betts and Ricardo Askim and I are headed to Stockholm. On September 28th, we'll be speaking at a conference in Stockholm. It's a wonderful, I'm running the economics track. It's incredible. It's going to be Richard Werner, Arno Wellens, and hopefully you're coming in on a pre-record. So you can stream online, and if you go to our events section, you can just click, and if you want access to the Saturday stream, this is going to be an amazing gathering. And
wait, where is this? Where did you say it was?
It's in a castle outside of Stockholm.
Okay, in Sweden.
It's literally in a castle.
Okay.
Okay, and then I'm going to be, Ricardo, Carolyn, and I are flying over to Oslo in Norway to do a presentation, and then one in Stavanger, and we just sent out an update about that, and you can click in information if you're in Norway and want to join us. You can see information there. And then if you keep going down the events section, I'm going to be in Kansas City at the Weston Price Conference on October 20th to 22nd.
Yeah, I can't scroll down. That's just an image.
Yeah. And then I'm going to be at the CHD conference in Savannah, Georgia. I do want to mention, hot off the press, Pharma Food. It's done.
Oh, wow.
It's beautiful. It's just beautiful. And of course, the topic is so creepy, but Robert outdid himself with let me see if I can find a good example of, yeah, so lab-grown meat, creepy. Can you see that?
Oh, God, yeah. Actually, I can. Wait, it's amazing.
Here's my, he really went to town with.
That's horrifying.
Well, here's the thing. When you read this, because I normally don't like to, yeah. Here's another one. Can you see that one?
That one looks like on the, no, I can't see that. So it looks like a scuba diver with a harpoon.
Yeah. So I don't normally like to do creepy things, but I wanted people to understand what the people who brought you the injection, the pharmaceutical industry and the biotech industry, are planning on making a fortune on lab-grown meat and synthetic food. And I want, you know, Elsa von Humlen, who's an amazing researcher, was willing to do the hard work of really digging this out and getting into it. We've published our interview with her about it, which I recommend. But I wanted people to know how bad it was, because I want you to embrace your local farmer and do everything you have to do to preserve and protect and build local farming food supplies. Because if you don't have local supplies of fresh food, you are going to be eating synthetic lab-grown meat and insects.
It was like the Amish guy last week under attack saying, look, the meat is the medicine. That's why they're coming after you.
Right. But I wanted everyone to know. I wanted everyone to know how bad it is. And then, of course, after this one, we have the future of financial freedom, but then we have the Dutch farmers. And you'll see, look, there's a world of wonderful farmers and fishermen. Let's team up with them and protect our food supply, because we don't want to be eating the insects and lab-grown meat.
No, hell no.
When you read this, you'll know. You'll, this is not about return on investment. This is about making sure you have food.
Yeah, right.
Anyway. Yep. Okay, John, I don't even know what to say about next week. You just never know what's going to happen.
You don't know, because the government is just a criminal enterprise. You don't know what they're going to do next. You can't predict what they're going to do next. Yeah. There's no rules. Who knows what they're going to do?
All I can say is you got to know how to duck.
You got to know how to duck. Yeah. Right. That's what we're here for. Tell you where to duck.
I told you my favorite quote from Michael Venturi. He says, we all live in the South Bronx now because that neighborhood is proof that American civilization can stop. And if it does, there's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah.
Now, I think there's a lot we can do about it, but whatever you do, stop helping the Biden administration. You know, there is such a thing as shunning, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Right. Okay. Well, John, thank you very much. Great week.
Yeah. Well, a lot to cover. Anyway, we'll see you next week.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have a wonderful week. John and I will be back next week with Money and Markets. And thank you for joining us on the Solari Report.